There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. Another week, another leak. One week after a sheaf of leaked documents fingered Unaoil as a hothouse of global corruption, we get the Panama Papers, a massive document dump that reveals the extent to which Panama has been used as a tax haven for the world's plutocrats and the many global leaders who've been swift to stash their cash offshore. The system is broken, but we'll break down the story with the help of Americans for Financial Reform's Alexis Goldstein. Meanwhile, 6 years ago, an explosion at Massey Energy's Upper Big Branch mine in West Virginia claimed the lives of 29 coal miners. This week, a court has rendered a sentence on Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship and his involvement in a conspiracy to systematically flout safety regulations. His punishment? 1 year in jail. And if that seems deeply screwed up to you, we will help you nurture your outrage. Finally, with every passing week on the campaign trail, resolution seems further away and tensions keep getting ratcheted up. We'll discuss the New York Daily News interview that caught Bernie Sanders up in a hot sack of nonsense. Plus, Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan joins us to talk about how his fellow Wisconsinites voted in this week's primary and how they may vote again in the general. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Ryan Grimm, and Paige Lavender. But here's what happened first. Hello, good day, and welcome to everyone in America, the world, and all of our ships at sea. This is Jason Linkins, host of So That Happened, and editor of Eat the Press of the Huffington Post. We have a good podcast today. And joining us right off the bat, we have our pal, Zach Carter.
Whoo, boy. Getting up from this great sleep I've been having in the tent where I live in the studio.
Yep, I can't wait for the next season where we upgrade that storyline. and on the other microphone from,
Americans for Financial Reform.
Americans for Financial Reform. We have Alexis Goldstein.
Hey, guys.
From Planet Smart About Things.
So, guys, a great man named David Lee Roth once said, Panamaha.
He had a point.
Last week, we had a big leak story to talk about, the Unaoil case. And, like, over the weekend, someone said, we'll see your Unaoil and raise you the Panama Papers.
Hey, I got awards on the line here, man. You can't say that it's better than the Unaoil leak.
Okay, you're right. It's as good
It's good stuff.
As the Unaoil leak. And to a certain extent, Zach Carter was right about Panama.
Oh, it feels so good.
Which we'll get to.
But love being
first
right.
First of all, let's walk people through what were the Panama Papers, in case you didn't hear about it. And it wasn't really well covered in mainstream news, so there's that.
Weird. Weird how a story about international corruption and tax evasion didn't get a whole lot
of
coverage.
Okay, so it's a story about international corruption and tax evasion, but what is it precisely?
Alexis, would you like to give the...
Well, it's essentially a company located in Panama that provided shell corporations for people that wanted to hide their taxes. And it turns out a lot of very powerful, very politically connected people were using them to hide money. And shell corporations are used by people all over the world. And it sort of manifests itself in the United States. To give you a very specific example is Miami real estate market, for example. Mm-hmm. A lot of apartments are being purchased, like multi-million dollar condos, by shell corporations. And you can't really see who the actual beneficial owner is. And so you have all of this real estate being gobbled up by who knows.
Right.
And it turns out that they're everything from dictators to politically connected people, and they're driving up the prices of real estate in Miami and probably in Manhattan and probably in San Francisco, and it's all basically laundered money that's flowing into the United States through the use of shell corporations. That's one of the sort of more narrow, local, U.S.-focused stories that we've seen out of this. The Miami Herald reported on that.
Right.
But this has implications all over the world. The Iceland prime minister had to resign over this because apparently he was using some of these shell companies as well.
It's funny how in other countries, politicians who use shell corporations to like hide assets and avoid taxes is like this really super embarrassing thing and people have to resign for it. Whereas in the United States, we just have presidential candidates who like openly use them and
as near as I can tell, it's just Iceland. It's just Iceland is the one place left on earth where there's actual accountability for doing these sorts of things.
It's a big deal in the UK too. David Cameron is taking some heat for this too. And he's, you know, from the Conservative Party. But, you know, Mitt Romney ran for president in 2012 and a big theme of his campaign was it's okay to hide your shit offshore.
As long as, you know, you're smart about it, right? You just have to be smart about it.
Yeah, don't break the law. Just don't pay the taxes.
Technically, these people were being, I guess, quote unquote, smart about it. But the problem is that there was a massive leak of documents that
I think
that
it was 11 million.
It's a huge amount of data. And there's the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists.
Yeah, that's
Michael
right.
Hudson is their director. He wrote the book Monster about AmeriQuest and the subprime financial crisis.
Deval Patrick! sorry, I just had a cough there. I mean, ICIJ is really good, and they've got a lot of people working on this. And you know, they do this right. There will be stories about this for years to come, because there's just so much information.
Well, and they keep hinting that there's going to be more revelations about people from the United States. I haven't seen anything spectacular yet, but it seems to have been focused on folks outside of the U.S. so far.
Yeah, so far. And who knows? I mean, this one particular company, Mossack Fonseca,
they were like number four, so maybe people in the U.S. only use like number three, two, and one.
You're right, and the thing about this leak, also with the Unaoil leak, it's not like we didn't know that Panama was an offshore tax haven. I mean, in 2011, I called a guy to set up an offshore shell corporation and bank account in Panama, and asked them, "Will the U.S. Free Trade Agreement and its tax information agreement in any way infringe on my privacy or my ability to avoid taxes?" And I was told, no, this will not affect you in any way. And then I said, I'm a reporter. And then the conversation ended. But I mean, this is something that we know has been going on for a long time. And that essentially the U.S. government has been sort of winking and nodding at as an okay thing to do. I mean, there was no reason to do a free trade agreement with Panama in 2011 other than to say the status quo is basically okay. I mean, their GDP is like 0.2% of the U.S. GDP. They're not like a big agricultural producer. There just aren't a whole lot of businesses that make a whole lot of sense to be pursuing this free trade agreement. Their main economic thing in Panama is operating as a tax haven. And so, surprise, here's a whole bunch of data showing that they're a tax haven. But I think these journalists need to be given a lot of credit for actually being able to detail the way this thing works and making it hard for people to ignore it, right? Like the President Barack Obama had to talk about offshore tax haven abuse in Panama as a result of this leak, even though he signed the free trade deal, which, you know,
allowed it to happen.
Well, not allowed, but yeah, allowed. I think allowed is fair, which made essentially cemented this as the status quo. As the way the U.S. will relate to Panama. But we'll see about these Americans. I mean, it is interesting. You know, you never know how these leaks come about, right? I don't think you can blame the journalists for writing about something when it's obviously good shit on corruption.
And they spent a year working on it.
Right.
It's not like this happened, you know, they just decided it's an interesting time to do this. They've been working on this for a year, poring over the documents, trying to figure out what the most interesting stories to tell were.
Why is this story important for just ordinary people?
Well, I think that if you think about it, in the example I used before about the real estate market, if you feel like you're being priced out of, if you live in a city and you feel like you're being priced out, a lot of that is because people are allowed to basically launder money into the United States and hide it in real estate. They do it a lot in San Francisco. There's a lot of vacancies in some of the apartments in San Francisco. It happens a ton in Manhattan and other parts of New York.
Yeah, it's really
I'm sure
bad
it's happening in D.C. too. And the Treasury, through its FinCEN department, which kind of like investigates money laundering and terrorism and things like that, have just in January started looking at people that are using all cash to buy apartments, but they're only looking at it in Miami and New York. And hopefully something like this will lead them to start to look into other cities, maybe even broaden it to not just all cash offers, but maybe 90% cash offers.
the promise that's being made to people who are increasingly finding themselves being priced out of housing markets is that big developers to develop luxury condos and things, luxury apartment buildings, are adding to the real estate market, and eventually it will filter down and make things more affordable. But it doesn't become more affordable if you can just, you know, purchase it at a high price and then leave it vacant.
If a ton of rich people keep bidding up the price for real estate through secret offshore accounts, it's really hard to see how that turns into lower real estate prices for ordinary people.
Or forget even about that. I mean, people are hiding money overseas in these shell corporations, which means that regular, ordinary people who use TurboTax to pay their taxes are essentially contributing more because these people are able to hide their funds, and we have less revenue to do things like make affordable housing or repair public housing or invest in our infrastructure. So it's just a huge, and I think the U.S. government has been complacent in some ways in this for a long time. There are steps that they could have taken to sort of tighten some of the rules around this to make sure that this happens a bit less. And I think that they've been a little bit hands off. Just a shout out to Senator Carl Levin, who, when he was in the Senate, kind of made offshore tax havens a point.
Big deal,
I feel
yeah.
like not too much happened in the wake, despite his heroic efforts to try to call attention to this prior to the Panama Papers.
You know, Panama is not the only offshore tax haven, right? You've got Monaco, the Virgin Islands,
Monaco,
Bermuda, et cetera.
And even this company mostly used the British Virgin Islands, so they happen to be based in Panama, but they weren't just offshoring in Panama. They were helping people offshore in the British Virgin Islands a lot, too.
Right. So this is a big international network, but we did have an opportunity to do something serious about this in 2011, and President Barack Obama signed a tax information agreement with Panama. And, you know, if that agreement had been really strong and had been good, we would have seen a lot of prosecutions for tax evasion of U.S. people. You guys remember all those big prosecutions of tax evaders, right? Remember those?
Sure, no. Did not happen.
All right. So we had an opportunity to do something about it, and we didn't. And that's the story of a lot of the Obama presidency is, well, sometimes we care about international elites doing terrible things with financial markets. Sometimes we're kind of okay with it, and we're willing to paper over it with an agreement that doesn't really do anything.
Okay, well, we will have Alexis back on in a little bit to talk about something else, but there you have it, Panama Papers. Massive corruption. Please keep leaking documents. We love leaked documents. My email address is jason@huffingtonpost.com. All right, we'll be right back.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to So That Happened, your one-stop clearinghouse for Wisconsin representatives. And today we have a treat. Joining me and our pal Arthur Delaney,
hi.
We have on the line with us Congressman Mark Pocan of the 2nd District of Wisconsin, where Madison lives. Congressman Pocan, welcome.
Thank you, guys. Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you. So let's just start real easy. There's an election this week in Wisconsin, Democratic and Republican primary. I bet you're itching to tell us who you voted for.
Well, you know, I think we had a pretty interesting day. We like Minnesota and Michigan, went with Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side. And on the Republican side, I think we maybe helped them jumpstart and save their party. Even though I don't think a single person who endorsed Ted Cruz in Wisconsin actually wants him to be president, they knew that that was the path to a open convention, so I think they succeeded in delivering that message. So we had a good primary day, and you know, we're going to see where things take us in both parties from here.
Congressman Pocan, tell us a little about that Republican side of the primary. I've heard people say Wisconsin is just too nice, too decent for a guy like Donald Trump to succeed. Do you think that's a smart analysis?
Yeah, you know, Donald Trump is kind of like, you know, trying to sell Velveeta in Wisconsin. You know, we know real cheese, you know, and he's just not the real thing. And, you know, people are fundamentally nice in the upper Midwest, I think a little bit humble. And, you know, he kind of is the exact opposite of all those things. So it wasn't a state that was tailor-made for him. He made a number of gaffes along the way. We have a big conservative talk radio presence in the Milwaukee area. And someone who's been trashing him for months, he accidentally wound up on that program.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was really showing that Donald Trump, I think a lot of the things that we thought maybe he was being clever and pulling when he's hit on some things, I think it's been just him throwing it against the wall on his own. And in this case, he didn't know where the wall was in Wisconsin.
So you voted for Ted Cruz.
You know, I have to admit, I did think for a little bit about voting for Donald Trump. I thought, you know, why not throw those guys in knots? But and I know a few people who did that. But you know, in the end, I think you know, Republicans stayed pretty much in the Republican primary. Democrats stayed pretty much the Democratic primary. Very little eventfulness in that area.
So I get the sense you're being coy here with your vote, and I think there's one of the reasons may be that you are a superdelegate, correct?
Yeah, you know, and the way I look at a superdelegate is, you know, based on the way I think it was intended, which is, you know, if there are adjustments and things you need throughout the process, because it's a long process, superdelegates have the flexibility to switch who they support and things. And so I've just said for quite a while that I was waiting until we get through all the primaries and caucuses, which is, you know, somewhere around mid-June after the, I think, D.C. may be the last one. And then I'll figure that out. But, you know, I don't really know a whole lot of people who are just dying to know who I was supporting so they could support someone. I mean, you know, people had very, very strong opinions on who they're backing. To me, the most important thing is keeping an eye on the prize, which is November. You know, we've got to have someone who's going to appoint Supreme Court justices, who's going to have the power of the executive order, who's going to appoint all the cabinet secretaries and deal with all the agencies. You know, that's a lot of stuff that's really important. And I think it's more important that everyone get back together in November. Some of us, including people like Barbara Lee from California and others, have had this conversation, and we feel we're more credible by not endorsing and not getting involved and trying to help bring people back home as we need to when the time is really most important.
It's getting a little chippy out there. Bernie Sanders said that Hillary Clinton is, quote, not qualified due to her paid speeches and other malfeasances. Do you have any concern that it's getting a little too chippy?
You know, that was the first one, and I think, you know, I heard the both interactions, and, you know, I mean, Hillary Clinton was probably a little too clever by half by not saying that he was qualified, because they've had a respectful relationship, and I think Bernie Sanders overreacted with a little bit of a diatribe about how she wasn't. But, you know, if that's the worst thing, our worst action is better than the best day in the Republican primary. So I'm not too concerned. You know, no one's discussed the size of their body parts or talked about the other person's spouse in a significantly negative way. I think we're doing all right.
To get it back to the Republican side, you said in the opening here that you felt like a lot of your Republican colleagues statewide were kind of holding their noses a bit and casting a vote for Cruz. Obviously, we've talked to Congressman Reed Ribble on the show quite a bit. He's sort of as fanatical and anti-Trump as you can be when you're sort of a steady, level-headed Wisconsinite. It's weird to me. In a parallel universe, and maybe you haven't had personal dealings with Ted Cruz, but in a parallel universe where Ted Cruz was maybe only 75% of the jerk he's been to his colleagues, would he be faring better in this nomination process? Or are his policies too out of step with even the sort of lion's share of Republicans in Congress?
Well, I mean, I believe, and I could be wrong, but I believe his only formal endorsement on the Senate side is Lindsey Graham, who's also said that if Ted Cruz was shot on the floor of the Senate, no one would finger the shooter. That's not a great rigging endorsement. And, you know, he's the guy who comes and stirs up our Tea Party on our side. I don't think people take him especially seriously. And he does have some pretty extreme views. You know, he wouldn't bring in a single new voter. So, I mean, I have to admit, part of me is torn. If Ted Cruz is the nominee, they pretty much will have the bottom base that they have come out, because there's no real new people going to look at Ted Cruz and say, wow, what an interesting politician. What an interesting concept. But Donald Trump has, you know, insulted so many people that, you know, he's going to have some difficulties, and where, you know, maybe some people who watch All-Star Wrestling will come out and vote for him that, you know, don't normally vote, that could give him maybe a little bump. Either way, they're in trouble, and I think that's where the whole reboot thing happens, right? Why I contacted some of my Republican friends who endorsed Cruz in Wisconsin, and I'm like, I sent the text, you know, hey, I think I finally found a line in your press release where you said something nice about Ted Cruz, and they laughed back. Cause, you know, they know that, you know, their message was, let's get to a do-over, but, you know, it's kind of hard to have a do-over, and what does Donald Trump do at that point? So, they're, you know, they wish they had the superdelegate process, I think, right now that we have on the Democratic side, is they don't quite know how to adjust for this.
There's a debate mostly on the left over whether Ted Cruz is as bad as Donald Trump, even though Donald Trump, you know, openly says he doesn't like anything that this country stands for. I wonder where you fall in this debate. Do you think they're comparable, or do you think Donald Trump is something else?
Well, you know, Ted Cruz is, you know, definitely extremist. He kind of personifies the Tea Party, which is a subset of the Republican Party. So, you know, he would be more extreme. You know, Donald Trump is just kind of running this xenophobic, misogynistic, racist campaign, but he's also got a populist tone around trade in China. But, of course, it's a hypocritical tone because all of his ties and things are produced in China, and he brings in workers from other countries to do his projects here. I mean, he's more of a populist guy, a billionaire who wants to get elected president. And, you know, I think in the end, Ted Cruz is probably, you know, more extreme when voters really get a chance to look at it. Donald Trump he wants to compete with Triumph the Insult Dog. And, you know, that's kind of an interesting campaign strategy, but like insulting Scott Walker in Wisconsin, even though Scott Walker said that was like, you know, attacking Brett Favre or Aaron Rodgers, which is quite an overstatement, quite an ego that Scott Walker has. Still, it wasn't probably the smartest strategy in Wisconsin in a Republican primary to attack your sitting Republican governor.
Yeah, it was like he was almost trying to throw that race. One last question, because we don't talk a lot about down ticket races. Maybe it's generally too early, but you have a genuinely interesting Senate race in Wisconsin between the incumbent Ron Johnson and the man he defeated, Russ Feingold. How do you see the lay of the land there? And can you provide us with any insight of how it came to pass that Russ Feingold fell out of favor in the first place?
Yeah, well, it was 2010. But, you know, what's really interesting is I was active in the legislature at the time, is in 2010, people actually said to Russ, I like you. I just think it's time for a change. And so some of the stronger feelings nationwide when they're throwing Democrats out of all sorts of offices hit Russ in a little bit different of a way, because people still really liked Russ. And he used to go to every single county, 72 counties, for a listening session every single year. And since he announced in his first 100 days, he did that again. Ron Johnson has two offices in the entire state. And I think if you asked him any direct routes between cities, he wouldn't know them because he hasn't spent the time back home doing what Russ used to always do.
Burn.
Midwest burn.
You've got a lot of different approaches here, and I think, you know, Russ still has that goodwill, and in Wisconsin, in a presidential year, that'll pay out.
Well, it's going to be an interesting race to see. It's all quite interesting all down the line, and Wisconsin could play a major role in determining both presidential fortunes and congressional fortunes down the line. Congressman Pocan, thank you very much for joining us today. We hope we have you back soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And we will be right back. Hey, guys. We'll get back to the program in just a second. I just wanted to take a minute to welcome all of you into my safe space here, to thank all of you for tuning into the show and helping us to create an Inside the Beltway show for Beltway outsiders and make it a reality. We love hearing from you. Your feedback has been such a tremendously good, positive influence on us every week. Now, you can help other people find out about this show that you're helping to build. If you are an iTunes user, please look for our show. Subscribe if you haven't. And use iTunes' widgets to rate our show and to leave us a comment. It will help people like you find this show, and we can keep building what we've got going together. So head on out to iTunes, subscribe, rate, and say hello to us and your fellow listeners. Thanks so much, guys. And now, here's something else that happened. Hey, we're back. Back with Zach.
Hey.
Back with Brian Grimm. Sorry, your name doesn't rhyme with back.
Hmm.
It's all gone off the rails already. This week, the New York Daily News sat down with an editorial meeting with Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders. And I remember I came to work that day and I read it and nothing particularly jumped out at me, but what a friggin' idiot I am, because it was basically a world-changing, outrage inducing interview for some reason. Why?
Yeah, the pile on began pretty quickly with people, you know, clipping little bits of it and screenshotting it and passing it around and saying, this is just the most unpresidential. This shows that Sanders is all hype, that Sanders is all big ideas and no idea how to get them done, doesn't really know what he's talking about.
They're basically saying he's a lightweight without saying he's a lightweight.
There are parts of the interview where I think he is a lightweight. I mean, he does not come across as deeply interested about foreign policy in any way, shape, or form. He's got a few flashcards he throws at interviews that essentially encapsulate some painfully generic positions. And I've always wondered why that's the case, because I would have expected more from someone who
takes such an outsider approach
to policy.
And he came up during the Vietnam War, which you would think would have inspired him to think more about foreign affairs.
But for some reason, this all got tangled up in this idea.
And you used to care about the, you know, the left down in Central and South America.
Right, right. But instead, we found out that everyone's mad or upset, or I don't know what the right word for it is, jumping around like a dipshit because of his answers to questions like how would he wind down big banks. I have to say, I read his answers to how he would wind down big banks, and I found them completely standard what I would expect him to say. Why on earth was this a big deal?
I think, for the most part, people don't actually study financial policy, which is why people like me have a job doing it and explaining it to people, because it's kind of boring. And so you assume that complex financial institutions like JP Morgan Chase or Citibank would require some very complex, detailed plan from the federal government if you're going to break them up. But in fact, you don't. All you have to do is set an asshole threshold, you know, some percentage of GDP. It's what they did with Brown-Kaufman as an amendment to Dodd-Frank back in 2010, an amendment which did not pass. But you set some asset level threshold. You can't get any bigger than this. And then you just tell a bank, downsize as profitably as you can to that level. You let the bank figure it out. This is what companies do this all the time in mergers. They make divestments and spinoffs. It's not that complex a set of corporate decisions. And that's basically what Bernie Sanders said. And people freaked out because they're like, wait, it's got to be more complicated. And it really doesn't have to be.
What do you think, Ryan? What do you think people expected him to say about this matter other than there's a law I will use to do it?
I think part of his problem came in his honesty when he would say, and this was throughout the interview, he'd say, I don't know, or I haven't thought about that. And part of it came in that exchange. There was this weird moment where over and over the Daily News kept flipping the script back to talk about the Federal Reserve when Sanders was answering about the Treasury Department and the administration, because Dodd-Frank gives the Treasury Department the authority to unwind systemically dangerous banks.
Well, it gives a whole bunch of regulators working together the authority to do that. One of them is the Treasury Department, the Treasury Secretary. One of them is the Fed Chairman. One of them is the head of the FDIC. Right. I mean, it's a lot of regulators.
Right, and they kept flipping back to the Fed. The Fed, can the Fed do this? And he said, look, I don't know if the Fed can do it.
Because literally no one knows.
It is an open legal question if the Fed alone could do it. His answers were from a kind of rhetorical perspective lacking. If you read a transcript from somebody like President Obama, it reads like he sat down and wrote it and copy edited it. You know, he talks in these fluid paragraphs. That's not how Bernie Sanders speaks. Part of it is that Obama likes to hear himself speak.
Right.
And he's very good at it. And he enjoys the process of he invites people over for hour and a half off the record sessions to just speak to them about what's on his mind, domestic affairs, foreign affairs, whatever. It would be hard to imagine Bernie Sanders doing that.
Oh, you know, yeah, absolutely.
He doesn't enjoy it, so he just kind of rat-a-tat-tats it and wants to move on.
I also think, to some extent, it's very difficult to believe that all of these questions asked by the New York Daily News were asked in good faith. I mean, one of them was about a court decision on a certain too-big-to-fail institution that came down last week, which has been quite controversial, in large part because the actual decision itself has not been sealed. It is not publicly available. So Bernie Sanders was literally asked a question about the legal implications of a court decision that nobody has read.
But it's
ridiculous.
But on the other hand, he didn't say that. He didn't say nobody's read that. It just came out. So he's like, oh, I haven't really looked at that very closely.
Yeah.
So he didn't do himself any favors, but they were certainly, you can go from the very beginning of that transcript and see immediately that they're trying to trip him up. They start out on trade, and he handles it just fine. Then they move to how are corporations undermining the fabric of society, trying to like kind of fact check that big claim of his. And he talks about banks, and then there's, well, like, what about non-banks? Can you name any non-bank corporations?
He talks about GE.
Yeah, and he brings up GE, and he's like, do you think Apple's destroying America? And he says, no, I don't think Apple's destroying America, but I wish they would pay taxes and build some of their phones here in the U.S. And they say, well, how is that undermining the fabric of the United States? And he's like, well, you know, if you have less tax revenue and you have fewer jobs, then I'm not trying to be hyperbolic here, but, you know, that's part of the fabric.
And you know what?
Jobs and tax and revenue.
What struck me, besides the fact that my big takeaway from the interview is that maybe the New York Daily News editors don't quite understand the fact that the Treasury and the Federal Reserve are two different entities, and that Dodd-Frank empowered one of them to take care of too big to fail banks and not the other. But it seemed to me like they were hunting for more hyperbolic answers than Sanders was prepared to give. I think they literally expected Sanders to say, my plan to unwind big banks is to fucking personally get in the weeds of these banks and start calling shots and like literally pick them apart according to my own recipe. When all he was really saying was like, what you said, we'll set an asset threshold and you guys decide what's best for you and paring down, but you got to pare down.
This basic view about how to break up the banks, that is not a new idea. That has been around literally since 2010, at least. That is the process by which break up the banks advocates attempted to break up the banks in 2010 in Dodd-Frank and failed. They couldn't get that amendment passed. But this is not a new idea. And people who are asking questions about financial reform and Wall Street reform should be aware of that as a potential answer. And you know, when you're asking these questions like, oh, you're going to do it by Federal Reserve fiat, you're just going to dictate to them. I mean, those are just bizarre questions. And it's hard, you know, they're not questions that are asked by serious people in good faith.
The Israel-Palestine one was kind of interesting too, on a bunch of different levels. And they asked some weird questions there. How should the Israeli military have attacked Gaza so that there were fewer civilian casualties? And he was like, first you're asking me to run the Israeli government policy on settlements. Now you want me to run their military policy. He's like, I don't know. Don't bomb the hospitals and the kids.
Stop killing people.
And then they said, what about settlements? He said, yeah, you know, they should pull back the settlements that are illegal. Well, how do you determine what's illegal? He said, well, if they violate the treaties. They're like, oh, okay, well. And they said, well, now, you know, you're radically reshaping. That's a dramatic departure from the U.S. position. If the new president comes in and says you have to pull back settlements, that really shakes the negotiations up. How does that affect the prospects of a two-state solution? And in fact, the idea that the Israelis should have to pull back their illegal settlements has been a part of the U.S. position since George W. Bush.
Central.
At least, if not going back further than Bush. So there was a weird element of, we're going to get this guy, and it doesn't matter.
I have one last question here. in aren't Clinton supporters who have been like dialing down on this interview kind of giving away the game and saying, by the way, we have zero interest in financial regulatory reform. It's not an issue for us. We're not going to work on that at all while Hillary's in office. It's a dead issue. We don't care about it.
Well, I don't even know if this is the time that they signal those kinds of things. They're just trying to bury him. And if that means forgetting that they themselves have said Dodd-Frank gives us the ability to break up the banks, then they'll just forget about that. That's fine. It's hand-to-hand combat. And they're trying to stick the knife in him, and the Daily News handed him his knife and said, "Here's his gut.
Check out the knife."
Yes,
I don't know. I think it's a rhetorically difficult thing for the Clinton campaign to have done. I mean, you can see spokesmen mocking, "Oh, but breaking up the banks, it's so fun to say," and they're using fundraising off of this. You know, sending out the transcript in a fundraising email. To me, I think that does suggest that that's the campaign sending a signal that these types of things are not important to them. And if they want to correct that signal, they can just send a different signal.
I'll leave you guys with this. I was reading Facebook like an idiot, and there was this article going around from some organization called Garnet News. Who the fuck knows who they are? But it was a weird, like, total hit piece on Sanders that basically said, Sanders says that Wall Street is a business of fraud, but look at all of his Wall Street investments. And like, I was prepared to see, oh, maybe Sanders like put money in like terrible industries. And like, literally this news organization simply said, like, had a list of like bog standard IRA retirement plan index funds. And we're saying is like, this is proof he's a hypocrite. And it left me with the feeling that Democrats really need to do more to teach people what financial institutions are bad and which ones are good, and what it means to be a Wall Street critic, and what it means to reform Wall Street. It doesn't mean pull your money out of the stock market and not have retirement accounts, and it certainly doesn't mean defame a man for having retirement accounts while simultaneously suggesting Wall Street could do better by people. And in an environment like this, where this is the knife being used, is taking Democrats far further and further away from some essential lessons that they should manifest in their own platform about financial regulatory reform.
Yeah, there really is no socialist alive who isn't a hypocrite, right? I mean, there's not much.
We're all trying to make a buck.
We over at HuffPost did some ridiculous hit piece on Sheila Bair about 5 years ago where it was a piece that said, aha, Sheila Bair says whatever she says about banks, but she has a mortgage from Bank of America.
Who wrote that?
At market rates.
Who wrote that?
I don't remember who wrote it. They're not here anymore. Not because of that. But I remember it being a hilariously bad, like, yes, she has a mortgage at 5.5% on her on her modest home.
Oh, well.
She and her husband own.
It's a terrible, terrible campaign season. I think that we can all agree on that. All right, Zach, Ryan, thank you. There'll be some new bullshit to talk about next week, but that's what we got for you today.
We'll see.
We'll be right back. We're back. So precisely 6 years ago in Raleigh County, West Virginia, 29 coal miners working at a Massey Energy mine were killed in an explosion, the worst mining disaster in the United States since 1970. A subsequent investigation found that the disaster was, as they say, completely avoidable and caused by numerous flagrant safety violations that went purposefully ignored by those in charge of the mine. This week, those dead miners and the community that has supported them during this time finally got a taste of what justice is like in America. It's tiny and it's bitter and it's not capable of fitting the crime. Don Blankenship, the CEO of Massey Energy, was convicted of conspiring to violate federal mine safety standards, which sounds pretty good. And indeed, it is perhaps one of the few times a CEO of his caliber has ever been convicted of a crime like this. But when it starts sounding bad is when you find out what the punishment was. He is getting 1 year in prison, 1 year of supervised release, and will pay a $250,000 fine. To put it in context, this is a man who made $19 million his last year as charge at Massey Energy for killing 29 people. Joining us to talk about this is our friend Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
And Huffington Post politics page editor and West Virginia resident extraordinaire, Paige Lavender.
Hello.
Paige, it's your birthday this week.
It is.
So happy birthday.
The whole week is my birthday.
Right.
That's how it works.
That's excellent.
It's a pretty good deal that you get around here, a week-long birthday.
Yeah.
But so here's my present for you, is we get to revisit a story that I know has, that you have actually covered quite extensively, mm-hmm. and which still, I think, rouses a certain amount of emotion in you. I remember yesterday when I came to you and pitched the segment to you, you sort of like visibly flinched at the sound of me talking about Don Blankenship. So tell me about what it is like for people far from this Washington bubble, people in West Virginia, when they live through stories like this.
Yeah. So full disclosure, I feel like I should say that I had people that I knew who died at Upper Big Branch. So I mostly cover the sort of legal aspect of it, but I try not to get into the personal stories because I'm really tied up in that. Some extended family members there. And so I went to a few of the funerals, and I watched all of that unfold, you know, as it was happening, and it was very hard. And I think what makes it especially hard for Southern West Virginia is because, I mean, mining is such a way of life there. You know, if you want to have a decent living and you don't necessarily think college is right for you or vocational school is right for you, coal mining is such a great alternative because it pays very well. You know, you can make a whole career out of it. There are, you know, men who stay there, you know, start when they're 18 or 20 and stay there their whole lives and are able to support their family and have good insurance and, you know, all that. And so it just sort of, to use a very cheesy phrase, it sort of shook the core, I guess, of Southern West Virginia when this happened, because everyone knows somebody that goes to the mountains every day. I mean, when I had first heard about the explosion, like, I immediately texted my parents and I'm like, who do we know that works there? Because I knew we knew somebody. And so that's how it was felt, you know, when it happened. And then when you have this, the sentencing, which is just not enough. I mean, you know, I don't know how else to say it. 1 year and $250,000 for a millionaire is like, what is that? It's like a blink of an eye, and like he's going to be over it and whatever. It just feels wholly inadequate because so many people in that area pour their whole livelihood and their health. I mean, there are so many men whose health have been compromised by this industry. Like, setting aside any safety standards, you know, when you breathe in coal dust and day in and day out, it's going to impact, you know, the way your body works. And so for so many people to pour their life into this and for him to so callously treat workers and their safety and to consider their safety not at all, you know, it makes people lose a little faith in an industry that has really carried the state for a very long time.
And Blankenship spoke at the time of his sentencing, but it was just... Can you describe what that was like? I know people were not impressed.
So I actually went on a little Twitter rant about this yesterday, and I hate Twitter rants, so I hated myself a little for it. But to clarify for people... He wasn't charged with murder or anything like this. These charges were for, you know, willfully violating safety standards, which, like, technically, this has nothing to do with the explosion in a way. Like, he was violating safety standards all the time.
Right.
Then this explosion happened, and it kind of brought it to light. So,
and this is, like, looking the other way when you are making sure there isn't too much methane.
Right.
Or, you know, you're doing these safety checks, and they're done inadequately.
Exactly. And one of the Tommy Davis, who is my distant cousin and who lost his son and his brother and his nephew in that explosion, said yesterday that, you know, Blankenship makes phone calls all day long. He could have made one phone call to shut down the mine just to have somebody come look and make sure all the safety standards were up to par, and he never did. Anyway, so in his statement yesterday at his sentencing, he said he was sorry to the judge because he brought up Upper Big Branch, and the judge said, you know, this isn't about that. I don't need to be hearing about that because that's not what this case is about. So he said, I'm sorry then, but he never said I'm sorry. And he actually at one point phrased it, I want to express my sorrow to the families of these miners. Those miners were good men. And it's right. Like, just fucking say you're sorry, man. I'm sorry is all you have to say.
Yeah,
that's
it's
what
kind of
expressing
like putting himself on that level, same level as them.
Yeah, it's like expressing your sorrow.
I was affected by this too.
Yes, it's just like it blew my mind how like tone deaf his statements were at the sentencing. These miners were really great men. They did a really great job. And it's like, yeah, but you didn't, like, say that. You know what I mean? I know it's all rhetoric, and at this point, it's not bringing anybody back. It's not changing anybody's minds, but I just...
Had not allowed victims' families to speak at the time, so that's why he was like, Blankenship, you can't start talking about it now. You can talk about your...
Yeah, I think we have to leave aside the possibility that Don Blankenship may be an evil piece of shit, but... But leaving aside that, let's talk about the prosecution in this case. As the Washington Post reports, government officials who are trying this case really went to great lengths to try to portray Blankenship not just as a negligent owner of a mine, but as the, quote, kingpin of a criminal enterprise. There's who contributed to a, quote, unspoken conspiracy that employees were to ignore safety standards and practices if they threatened profits, unquote. What really strikes me about the case that the government who – the people, the officials who made the case really think they did a good job. Stephen R. Ruby, the assistant U.S. attorney who helped prosecute this case, gave a quote that said he quote urged the judge in this case to order a 1-year sentence in jail, arguing that a lighter penalty would quote signal that committing mine safety crimes might be a good gamble for a CEO. It was also reported that Labor Secretary Thomas Perez told the New York Times that the decision was sent, quote, a clear message that no mine operator is above the law, that there must be accountability when people lose their lives because of the neglect of their employer. So I'm reading on that, and I'm just like, I don't know. It still seems to me like it would be a pretty good gamble for a CEO to engage in these practices. Because 1 year in prison?
What, yeah.
A pittance of a fine?
The thing that's super weak about this argument. So, yes, he got 1 year in prison. He's paying $250,000, which some people are like, he got the max time.
He did. That's the largest penalty that's ever been applied to a case like that.
And that's true. And it's, isn't it kind of sad?
It's
1 year.
Sad.
And so I know that, I just went on this rant about how his trial wasn't related directly to the explosion, but... people were pointing out that 1 year equals like 12 and a half days for each miner that died in that explosion,
right.
Which is like so crazy to me. But also, he was actually acquitted of two felony charges, which carried more time. Like one of them was at least a 5-year sentence, I think. So the thing is he could have had a lot more time in jail. And at the time when, you know, before the ruling was made, people were, you know, hoping he would be guilty on all these charges or whatever. And so now it just sort of seems kind of like weak to think, oh, well, he got the whole year. And it's just like, well, you know, but they still like let him off on these other things. And I know it's very frustrating to me and to others that he could have spent a lot more time thinking about what he's done.
So he was convicted of a misdemeanor.
Right. Yeah.
And, our colleague Dave Jameson and I, we tried to reach out to some lawyers. Why is this a misdemeanor when nearly 30 people are killed? And the answer is under the Mine Act, all these violations other than actually falsifying the books is a misdemeanor. So it's basically a weakness in federal law that George Miller, who's formerly the chairman of the Education Labor Committee in the House, had tried to change but couldn't. So this is like a known weakness in our federal law that essentially allows people who do what Blankenship did to get this light punishment in the worst case scenario.
Yeah, what kills me about this is I'm quite sure that an opiate addict in Appalachia would do more time for his opiate addiction than this guy's doing for killing 29 people. That is galling to me, and it's a perverse the way justice seems to work. Yeah. Paige, it seems to me like we constantly cover stories like this out of West Virginia in particular. We had the Elk River spill not so long ago. And it's very difficult to get people to care about West Virginia because they're far from the madding crowds and, you know, here in Acela stand Cellar Corridor where all the media is. What is it like to live in a place like Raleigh County, West Virginia, and to endure this perception that perhaps these fates are deserved?
There is this perception that everyone in West Virginia, and particularly Southern West Virginia, especially in the last few years, is like a druggie or like a coal miner, and like they don't want to do anything. And like, I think that that is a lot of misconception. You know, West Virginia, I'm biased, clearly.
It's full of we wouldn't have you on if you weren't biased.
It's full of beautiful, hardworking, caring, passionate people. And I don't think that a lot of people see that. And so those people are there fighting for more regulations in the mines and more regulations in their water and things like that. You know, they want to, you know, embrace the coal industry while still expanding their opportunities elsewhere so that we don't have to have generations of coal miners relying on that as their main job for years to come. But I think a lot of people don't see it that way, looking from the outside in. So I don't have a solution for that or a reason for it, but I just, I don't know. I would hope that people would understand that not everything you read about the people there is true.
Well, you know, I'll just say this. The wealth of this nation was built by men who extracted wealth out of the ground and built the country, and they definitely deserve better than what they're getting out of this trial. And they deserve to have a better voice, and they deserve more justice. But
now there's going to be an appeal of his sentence by Blankenship, so less justice may be in the offing.
Yeah, go figure. Well, depressing news, but you know, if we don't talk about this stuff, things never change. So that's the way that is. Arthur and Paige, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you,
and happy birthday.
Thanks.
We'll be right back. So we just talked with Alexis Goldstein, our pal, about some bad things. But now, guess what? Good news. Good news for everybody. We're finally happy to bring you some good news. A new rule from the Department of Labor is going to help protect people who need protecting.
Yeah, we're here. It's going to be fun to talk about this.
Well, let's move on to, I guess, a thin ray of good news this week.
This is a big ray of good news.
All right, big
ray
of good
news.
This
is about as big as it gets.
All right, talk to us about good news, Zach.
I'm in a bad mood. I would really rather that Alexis do it because I don't want to bring people down.
All right, Alexis.
So if you are
be our ray of sunshine.
Okay.
Today.
So it turns out you may think that the person that advises you on saving for retirement always was obligated to try to give you good advice that would help you save.
Sure.
Better.
And their commercials, they talk about how they're going to help people.
Right.
I don't see commercials for retirement brokers saying, "Do battle with us and maybe not get screwed in the end."
Right. You know, it's like
old
someone
people.
Images of, you know, your child, and then they grow up, and then they're in a graduation cap, things like that. Well, it
and
turns
you get a boat.
Out.
You get a boat at the end.
Oh, yeah.
The
boat.
Everyone gets a boat.
Puppies.
A hole in the water into which you throw money.
It turns out not every person advising Americans on their retirement savings is actually looking out for them.
Wait, what?
Yeah. It turns out prior to yesterday, and it was perfectly allowed to.
Prior to yesterday,
it was perfectly allowed to steer people into things that weren't in their best interest if it happened to make the broker more money. So if I'm a broker and I get a higher commission because I steer Zach into the Stripes and Stars retirement account, I'm going
to
steer him
me.
Into that.
Woo.
And I'll just tell Zach
regardless
that it has a fancy
and
name and it
performs.
Sounds so good, right? But actually, there's something cheaper that would make Zach more money over time. But I'm not going to tell him about that because I get a kickback if I steer him into the Stars.
Surely you would have to tell me that you would be eligible for a, let's say, really fancy paid vacation for steering me into that account prior to this rule.
Nope.
I'm shocked. My gosh. You wouldn't even have to disclose it. Huh.
So the Department of Labor issued a rule that finally puts the kibosh on this.
That's right. So essentially, they have a new rule called the Conflict of Interest Rule. The White House had calculated previously that bad advice, conflicted advice, was costing Americans $17 billion a year. That was basically being taken out of American workers' pockets and put into Wall Street dealers' pockets. So this new rule essentially says that, no, you have to actually give people good advice that's in their best interest, that doesn't just benefit your bottom.
How did they pull it off? Because there's an enormous, the what I call the scam sector of our economy is one of the things that our government famously works to protect. The Debbie Wasserman Schultz right now is famously working to protect scammy payday lenders. And it's not a thing that you can find much of a, I mean, you can't really credit the Democrats for being stronger on the issue of getting the scam sector of the economy diminished. So well, how do we pull this off?
This has been in the works for years, and the Department of Labor proposed this
right?
many, many, many years ago, got scared, you know, withdrew it, and now it's come back. Secretary Perez deserves a lot of credit for pushing this, I think.
Secretary Perez.
It's not over because the Republicans are definitely going to, I think, I'm going to make the prediction, going to push back against this. The industry's probably going to sue. There's a representative named Ann Wagner who's basically made this her sole fight and said if she had to, she will defund the Department of Labor in
to
order to make
scammers.
Sure this rule does not go through. Yes, and she said that to a room full of Wall Street brokers who, of course, applauded her when she said that. That was a bit ago, but I think it's not over yet, but I think it happened because there has been years and years and years of advocates pushing for this.
Against the years and years and years of lobbyists for scam artists
let's,
who have been
let's,
leading.
And
let's not neglect the
so
role played by friend of the show, Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts.
Correct.
She's been, you know, pitching this for a long time. And the president. The president decided to resubmit this rule and decided that this was worth getting behind. And it was a fight worth fighting. And we give the president a hard time a lot of the times on the show about financial stuff. But this is one where he got it right and fought it.
Which is why we give him a hard time. So he'll get things right.
Well, it's tough when he gets it right. You're like, why can't you just get it right all the time,
credit,
man?
Credit to us, of course. We take credit too. But that's obviously good news. What more needs to be done to protect retirement savings?
Well, I think we just need to make sure that the rule goes forward, that we don't have too many people in Congress that are trying to pass new legislation to immediately overturn it. And so if folks are interested, Americans for Financial Reform, you know, has a little action out to write your member of Congress just to say that you support the rule. Or you could just call their office and say, hey, I heard about this conflict of interest rule. I just want to make sure that you're behind it and support it. But I think that there's a further battle to be waged over this. The industry will sue and then the Department of Labor will have to respond to that. But I think the rule will hold up in court. That's my prediction.
I think that's right. And I think if you pull back the lens a little bit here, you know, we have a retirement crisis in the United States. We often talk about it as if it's an entitlement crisis.
Correct.
Because this is the narrative that people who want to cut Social Security
retirement
benefits
spend. Retirement is an earned benefit, however.
You know, old people not living in squalor is sort of like a basic thing that
benefits all of us.
Decent societies do.
Wait, so you're saying you don't want people dying in the streets?
I'm going to own up to it. You know, this takes care of the sector or helps take care of the sector of people who have retirement accounts, right? And that's not that many people. Only about a third of the country actually has money in the stock market through these
right,
retirement accounts.
Right.
So this is a good rule. It's good. It's going to help things. But we have a broader problem with old people not having enough money to eat and live when they get old. And that's something we should focus on as a problem that needs to be solved, not just what the solvency of the Social Security program is. You know, Social Security is a tool used to fight poverty for the elderly. That is a thing that should not exist in a decent society, and we have real problems with that. So I think more broadly, that's something that just to acknowledge as a problem and to focus on.
I advocate on Social Security my Alex Rodriguez plan, my A-Rod plan, which is raise the income cap to the level of A-Rod's salary, make him pay Social Security, make his employer match it, and then go home and be happy. That's my plan. Pretty easy done, if it weren't for all the fucking lobbyists. But okay, that's outside of that, you know, invest conservatively in Vanguard index funds if you can.
Just Vanguard.
Vanguard's a good company. I'm in Vanguard index funds, and they're nice.
Dude,
they're
we're
nice.
Not even getting paid for that advertisement.
We're not. No, exactly. Exactly. Though I will take Vanguard's money if they want to send it to me. Anyway. So, mostly bad news, but some silver lining for people, but more needs to be done, and we need more people to come to Washington and help do it. That's basically what
we're
at.
So maybe if we get rid of these tax havens, we will have more money to make sure that old people don't live in squalor.
It's weird. If you want to solve poverty, you can just take money from the rich people and give it to the poor people.
Yeah, it's crazy. Crazy. What an idea. And you know what? The rich people still live pretty fucking happy.
They still get to be rich. It's crazy.
It's great. They can still buy a boat and throw their money into an ocean like all the other idiots with boats. Sorry, boat owners, but the best boats are other people's boats. They're not my boat. All right. Thanks for coming on the show, Alexis.
Thanks for having me.
And making bank lobbyists angry, which is our main point of view here. And Zach Carter, thank you. And we will be right back. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Christine Canetta. We are always watched over by our loving angel, Caitlin Bogucki. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan, Alexis Goldstein of Americans for Financial Reform, and Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Ryan Grimm, and Paige Lavender. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening, and we miss you already.